Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, April 1st. No pranks here today. The spies have been telling lies, and the Senate is upset.
Tell me lies, lies, lies. Sweet little lies. When I can't bear the truth. You tell me lies, lies, lies. Sweet little lies. Help me make them all come true.
Thank you, Michael Franti. Well, the dust-up continues in Washington, D.C., as they wrestle over the report on torture, detention, and interrogation. That is the subject of this ongoing squabble. And more is leaking out. We're told that Thursday, the Senate may vote to send this 6,000-page report to the White House for final approval. Could take months. In the meantime, information continues to leak out. And the Washington Post reports today, quote, a report by the Senate Intelligence Committee concludes that the CIA misled the government and the public about aspects of its brutal interrogation program for years, concealing details about the severity of its methods, overstating the significance of plots and prisoners, and taking credit for critical pieces of intelligence that detainees had in fact surrendered before they were tortured. Now, that last word, tortured, I substituted for the euphemism, subjected to harsh techniques. And this continues to infuriate me, that we know this report is about torture. We know that it includes graphic and detailed descriptions about the treatment of every prisoner who was tortured. We know that the techniques that were used went beyond a couple of cases of waterboarding, sleep deprivation, making people stand. We know that. And yet games are being played, and I can only deduce that the CIA is so concerned that the exposure of its wrongdoing will lead to further investigation and, perish the thought, investigations of those who approved it and those who carried it out. Now, to protect those who actually did the torture, the report has been completely scrubbed of the names of all of the people below the rank of supervisor. Now, that's not even a military description. But I guess those are CIA people, and so the rank and file. Those who were told to slam this guy's head into a wall, make him talk, I don't care what it takes. Well, they're going to be protected. And I'm not so interested in the frontline people anyway. But when you think of who approved this, a series of CIA directors like George Tenet, Porter Goss, Leon Panetta, Michael Hayden, and high-ranking CIA officials like John Brennan, the current director of the agency, who was knee-deep in the operations that included torture back in 2003 to 2005. Those are the people who are being protected. And as you've heard me discuss with Jason Leopold, the Senate Intelligence Report is technically not a report, because a report sounds like there was an investigation. It is a review. And I've commented on this before, as if a film critic is going to say, you know, the lighting in that scene wasn't very good. We couldn't see the water being poured down this guy's throat. So the latest step is that the Intelligence Committee is expected to vote to send a 400-page distillation, an executive summary, to Obama for declassification. And that, of course, may take quite a while. Now, one charge from the CIA is pretty interesting. They claim that this review reflects FBI biases. Now, I got a lot of axes to grind with the FBI, especially when it comes to domestic terrorism investigations, and you can be sure we're going to get to them today. But on the international stage, when the FBI went to Guantanamo, those agents came back and said, no way. We're not going to torture people here. And Ali Soufan, a guy in my view with kind of mixed credentials because he went to work as a consultant at Rudy Giuliani's company after he left the FBI. He's now an independent consultant. But Ali Soufan was an FBI agent who got people to talk without torturing them. And he got key witnesses to talk before they were actually tortured, like Abu Zubaydah. And this happened time and time again, where it appeared that Washington or Langley, the site of CIA HQ, was ordering these interrogations, including torture, to continue, even when the frontline people were saying, boss, it's not working, he's not talking. And that long-distance micromanagement, we know at some times occurred from the White House as members of the National Security Council were in real time sending messages to the torture locations saying, try this, try that. And Condoleezza Rice at one point said, gosh, do you think we should be doing this from the White House? As if her hands would be clean if the location were different. And so I'm prepared for the release of what will be a highly redacted report. But even still, it could have dramatic repercussions. And I would love to see an upswell, Americans speaking up and saying, God damn it, you tortured in my name, and I want those people held accountable. I would like to see a wave of that kind of demand so that Barack Obama can't continue to look forward and not backward. That's obstruction of justice in my book. And it has no place in this country. And our friend Jason Leopold, publishing at Al Jazeera America today, offers some very important thoughts about what'll happen even if parts of this review, do ultimately get released. And he notes that it could throw the hearings at Guantanamo Bay, the so-called military tribunals, into deep disarray. Why? Well, because for years, defense attorneys have been demanding to be able to show that their clients were tortured, to show that evidence being used against them was derived from torture. And they've been told you can't do that because it's all a secret. And even though your client knows that he was tortured, say Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he's not allowed to have access to tainted evidence derived from torture that might be introduced against him. And so this Kafka-esque, call it Catch-22, whatever you like, has been holding. But defense attorneys, some of whom have already demanded to see the full 6,300-page Senate Intelligence Committee report, will certainly be demanding to see the executive summary, if and when it surfaces. Now, I think this is only a good thing. I can't construct any kind of rational, logical argument that we should continue to pretend that things that aren't secret can be called secret in order to prevent them from being used in a kangaroo court proceeding against suspects who are already very clearly convicted even before the proceedings begin. And so this is going to be a very interesting set of issues. Of course, they hit during this midterm election cycle. when Republicans will pounce and try to make Obama look weak. And as you know, my concern is for his expansive use of presidential authority. And that's not something that the Republicans want to fight about, unless, of course, it's related to Obamacare. Every day we pause here to thank the people who support my podcast efforts with their subscription dollars. Mona Kobus, Michael Petty, Carl Harrison, Kevin Beckley. They're all monthly subscribers who support me with a PayPal deductible payment. And I'd like you to join them. Frankly, things are kind of tight over here. We've had some people who canceled their subscriptions or didn't renew for whatever reason. And if you're a regular listener and you value the information and the commentary that you get here, well, put a price on it. $5, $10, $20 a month. It's easy. You go to my website, peterbcollins.com, click on the sign-up link, and you'll see those options. The best deal is our $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers right here in the U.S. of A get our bonus gifts, a copy of John Dist's rockin' CD Red Flag, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans from the Big Island of Hawaii and our friend Russ Archibald. The other way you can support us is by taking our offer for a free trial subscription over at audible.com. When you sign up, they give you your first audiobook download free. You can cancel within 30 days, won't have to pay them anything. But no matter what you do, they'll pay me $15 for referring you and getting you to try it. It's a win-win scenario, and I hope you'll click on over there and take advantage of it. Well, I promised to take a few whacks at the FBI, and here we go. Vice News, and I'll put up a link to the story here, has an excellent report bylined Charles Davis, published here on April 1st. And he goes into some detail about a group of peace activists who originally gathered to protest the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, back in 2008. And they became subjects of FBI interest. And then arrives the paid FBI informant, using the name Karen. Karen infiltrates this group and continues to try to egg them on to violent acts, trying to get people to say things like, well, yeah, under certain cases, I'd throw a Molotov cocktail or I'd attack a police officer, all kinds of types of entrapment. And where I give this writer credit is that he takes us beyond the infiltration stage to show how the so-called Justice Department uses federal grand juries essentially to harass innocent First Amendment activists. And they do it by calling you in. You're not allowed to have a lawyer. They warn you that if you say anything that isn't true or you refuse to answer, that you could be penalized or held in contempt. And in the case that is covered in this article, they brought all these people before a grand jury. They paraded the testimony of the paid FBI informant, and then they never brought indictments. It was a way of putting a cost on free speech and kind of brushing back these individuals and making them think twice about actions they might want to take in the future. And this raises questions. By now, I think everyone in the country knows that the California State Senate has three members who have been suspended because they've either been indicted or, in one case, convicted of very serious crimes. And it's fair to say that the FBI used some of the same tactics. In the case of San Francisco State Senator Leland Yee, they had a paid FBI agent who was undercover and who infiltrated one of the Chinese criminal gangs in San Francisco in order to get close to this guy Raymond Chow, also known as Shrimp Boy. And Shrimp Boy had a long criminal record. He says he had reformed and was cozied up to by a lot of political leaders, including one of our favorites, Dianne Feinstein. And at one point, Shrimp Boy, talking to one of his associates, is asked if he thinks that this FBI agent is some sort of a plant. And Shrimp Boy says, well, if he is, he's a really good one. So I have to say that in general, I don't support the use of infiltration and provocateurs who help create crimes and then convict a subject who is being investigated of those crimes. I do have to say, though, when it comes to elected officials, I think the standard is a little different. Because infiltrating a known criminal gang is far different from putting a paid informant in the middle of a group of nonviolent First Amendment activists. The other thing is just a practical consideration. For years, it's been known that the FBI was paying close attention to members of the California legislature. They've presented warrants, they've searched offices, seized documents. The conviction of State Senator Rod Wright this past January was preceded by a year and a half or more of public investigation. Ron Calderon, who was finally indicted in February of this year and is still awaiting trial, his investigation surfaced almost a year ago. So Leland Yee, in many cases, doesn't deserve, as a public official who could look around and see what the FBI was doing in his midst, I don't think that he deserves the same kind of protection from entrapment and agents provocateur as First Amendment activists. Glenn Greenwald published an interesting think piece that does not include a new document from the trove supplied by Edward Snowden. Instead, Greenwald makes a contrast between the unauthorized leaks that have come from Snowden and from others at NSA with authorized leaks. And he points to an article recently published in the Los Angeles Times where some pretty interesting and what you would think is top secret information was leaked by the NSA to make its retiring boss, Keith Alexander, look good. Let me read from Greenwald's piece. Keith Alexander's longtime deputy just fed one of the most pro-NSA reporters in the country, the LA Times' Ken Delanian, some extraordinarily sensitive top secret information about NSA activities in Iraq, which the Times published in an article that reads exactly like an NSA commercial. And most notably, we have the deputy at the NSA trying to burnish the reputation of Keith Alexander, the embattled and stepping down leader of the NSA, by saying, wow, look what we did in Iraq. So, here's the direct quote. In Iraq, for example, the National Security Agency went from intercepting only about half of enemy signals and taking hours to process them to being able to collect, sort, and make available every Iraqi email, text message, and phone location signal in real time. So, when top secret information is leaked for PR purposes to make Keith Alexander look good, no problem. But, as Greenwald points out, when a journalist like him, or Bart Gellman at the Washington Post, or others, approach the government and say, we're about to publish this information, like the Post's scoop last week about the Mystic program, the one that allows the recording of 100% of a foreign country's communications? Yeah. Well, this is greeted by the NSA with doom and gloom statements. If you release that, agents will die. America will look bad. It'll make people hate our country. And they try to bluff media outlets and, most notably, their lawyers into submission. And Greenwald writes, leave aside how corrupted this rationale is. It would mean that no bad acts of the U.S. government should ever be reported, lest those disclosures make people angry and want to attack government agents. Indeed, that's the rationale that the Obama administration used to protect evidence of Bush-era torture from disclosure. He goes on to say, it highlights how cynical and frivolous are their claims that whistleblowers and journalists endanger national security by reporting incriminating information about their activities, which they have hidden, given how casually and frequently they disclose top-secret information for no reason other than to advance their own PR interests. Well, there's a deal brewing between the U.S. and Israel. For many years now, Israel has been demanding, pleading, wheeling and dealing for the release of Jonathan Pollard. He's an American citizen and a Jewish guy. He was a civilian intelligence analyst for the U.S. Navy when he gave thousands of classified documents to his Israeli handlers. Pollard was arrested in 1985. He's been behind bars ever since, serving a life sentence, and the Israelis want him sprung. So John Kerry, who's desperate to get some concessions from Israel, is dangling the release of Jonathan Pollard as a way to, for example, get Israel to agree to freeze the construction of illegal settlements, get them to release Palestinian prisoners beyond the list that is already agreed to, and to guarantee that Israel would stay at the negotiating table beyond the end of April. Now, frankly, I don't have any axe to grind here, and they could release Jonathan Pollard with no trade-offs without upsetting me. But we know that Israel wants his release so badly. Why wouldn't we make this a bonus for a peace deal? Not just some incremental step like freezing settlements. They should do that without a reward. And they should continue the talks or negotiations beyond the end of April without any inducement from the United States. So I hope that Kerry will extract a good payoff for the release of Jonathan Pollard, but I kind of doubt it. Our very own Perv, the man who did the bidding of the Bush administration for many years, has been charged with treason in Pakistan. He is Pervez Musharraf, former military leader. He seized power in 1999 in a military coup. But that's not what he's on trial for. It was back in 2007. He's accused of subverting the constitution of Pakistan when he imposed emergency rule and filed judicial officials in attempt to maintain his grip on power. And I think it's interesting because, you know, this is the same era of the war crimes committed by Bush and his team, including the torture issues that we raised at the beginning of this program. And Americans deride Pakistan as an unruly, ungovernable country where the military intervenes every so often to displace civilian leaders and then they kind of crawl back into power. And the judiciary in Pakistan is far from above reproach. But they're able to indict for treason their former president. And George Bush is painting puppies in a suburb of Dallas. Very interesting and argumentative piece at truthout.org today, written by Patrick Barrett, who is a professor at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, and the director of the Havens Center for the Study of Social Justice. And he ruminates about whether Bernie Sanders should run for president, and if so, whether he should run as a Democrat or as an independent. And it's a thoughtful, argumentative piece where he raises a lot of important issues. And he focuses primarily on the need to build a long-term progressive movement, and that looking for a messiah on a short-term basis and hoping that Bernie Sanders could miraculously win the presidency in 2016, well, he raises some important questions about that. He writes, in short, attempting to build a broad-based progressive coalition via a presidential run by Bernie Sanders in 2016 not only amounts to putting the cart before the horse, Like so many such failed efforts in the past, it also constitutes a potentially immense waste of precious resources and energies that would be better put to building politically autonomous social movements. Now, I understand his point. The problem is that the American left, for whatever reasons, and I won't try to resolve all this here, I think is incapable of the kind of long-term political investments that we have seen on the American right for the last 40 years. My own experience with the failed gambit of progressive talk radio, the Air America bomb. I had a syndicated talk show back from 2005 to 2009, and we could not build enough momentum to have a truly national footprint. There are a lot of reasons for that. The radio business is filled with Neanderthal conservatives. But Democrats did not provide the kind of infrastructure that Republicans have that permit them to dominate the media and put out false information on a daily basis. And we also saw that Occupy tried to raise important issues of class, of culture, of economic disparities, but because they didn't turn it into any kind of a political movement, and because Obama and the Department of Homeland Security rolled them up, there's really nothing today that we can say, oh yeah, well, you know, that bill passed or that law was enacted because of the activists in Occupy. And so I accept the argument here from Patrick Barrett that a Bernie Sanders run at the presidency is a very, very long shot. But we don't have a better shot. And to allow Hillary to just be anointed as the next Democratic leader, whether or not she faces Jeb Bush in a replay of the Clinton-Bush dynasty, I don't know. But for me, I would like to see Bernie Sanders run. I'd like to see him do it as a Democrat. That's the only way he can get on the ballot for the primaries and hope to build the machinery that, if he were able to best Hillary Clinton, would permit him to have a shot at winning. And while I recognize the risks that Patrick Barrett points out here, I don't think that we have any better options with better odds. Yesterday, Jerry Brown came to my part of California, just north of San Francisco in Marin County. He was attending the Environmental Council of the States. And he gave a pretty impassioned talk about the risks of climate change, and he showed he understands those issues very well. He also talked about the risk of inaction. He said human beings know how to screw things up in a big way without even knowing it, and being pretty damn happy about it before it happens. We are headed for something far worse, with far more suffering and far more disruption. It's not a slow walk to destruction, he said. We're playing Russian roulette with tipping points. He said there won't be an announcement. There won't be an initial news flash. It will slowly and inexorably spin out of control. Now, so far, so good. Then he was asked a question from a reporter about whether nuclear power has a role in reducing the human contributions to global warming. And he had a very terse answer, saying that nuclear energy has to be taken very seriously. Well, we've successfully taken one of the two remaining nuke plants in California offline permanently. That's San Onofre. And Diablo Canyon should be shut down as well. It's approaching the end of its projected life. It still sits on an active earthquake fault right along the coast. It is Fukushima, spelled Diablo Canyon. Jerry Brown's not willing to stick his neck out on that. Then he was asked about fracking. And his very orchestrated response is that, well, we're going to study it. All these things are being very carefully examined and researched. And he ticked off the issues of tainted water, the impact of diverting water to fracking to begin with, the fissures created and how that can lead to seismic events in a seismically active state like California. But curiously, Jerry Brown is going to keep studying this. He's not ready to reach a conclusion. And I have to say that other forces must be at play here. And finally today, my last item is just a notation. It's not really a news story. I read a tidbit in the business section of the newspaper today that the current stash of cash that Apple Computer has offshore has reached $160 billion. And what's interesting is that they were under pressure from shareholders and activist Carl Icahn over the past year to buy back stock, to pay out dividends, to reduce that cash hoard. And they took a couple of steps in that direction. They are paying dividends. But do you know that they borrow money against the cash stash to pay dividends? Because that way they don't have to bring the profits back to the United States and pay any tax on them. And because worldwide interest rates are so low, it's cheaper for Apple to borrow the money than to use its own stash of cash to pay the modest dividends that they have peeled off in the past year. And what offends me as an avid consumer of their products, and my avidness is offset by what I know about how those products are made at Foxconn in China. But I'm a fan of Apple. I've been using their computers since I got into computers. And I consider them an American company. But they don't act like it. And they made most of those profits here. They should bring that cash home, pay tax on it, and for God's sake, just man up and stop belly aching. Thanks for listening to my rants and raves. You're welcome to share this podcast with absolutely anyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again.